Shuttle Endeavour, we're going to need to lift off in about 5 seconds.
Copy that, Houston!
X-Files is the show. You know,
the truth is out there.
Welcome to the culture of contact. Contact begins now.
Hey there, you've reached Jeremy Vaney at the Culture of Contact. I'm not available to take your call, so please leave your name, number, and a brief message, and I'll get back to you as soon as possible. Take care.
Jeremy, hi, it's Tim Beckley. Nice to hear from you. And call me back. I will help you the best I can if you need some assistance. I don't really like to speak. It's just too much preparation. I'm a writer, that's why I write instead of speak. I'd be happy to do a panel discussion that I have no problem with. I also, of course, am involved in bands and movies. I'm, of course, you know, I'm Mr. Creepo, so I do have some product. It's not directly UFO related, but I do have one film, Skin-Eating Jungle Vampires, which is a very low-budget B movie, which takes place in a real cave under a volcano in Costa Rica. Someone was shot there and someone was shot here, about cannibalistic the aliens, all women, eating tourists. It's something you might like. The general public, it is non-rated. There is female frontal nudity and lots of gore. That's what I like to do when I'm not chasing real UFOs. Anyway, do get back to me, and we'll talk later. Bye-bye.
To review this message, press... Hello, everybody out there in the internets. My name is Jeremy Vaney. I'm the host of the Culture of Contact podcast. And before we get to my amazing interview with Whitley Strieber about his new book, 2012, The War for Souls, I'd like to introduce you to another amazing man. His name is Harold Egeln, and Harold has been instrumental in getting this Culture of Contact thing up and running from the very beginning. Harold is a reporter by trade. He is an experiencer, and he will be our residential reporter here on the Culture of Contact. So without further ado, Harold, thanks for joining me.
Hi. Hi, Jeremy. I'm so glad to be on the podcast.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Well, thank you. This is, you know, partly your baby as well.
Right.
So I thought it would be kind of cool if maybe instead of me blabbing away, if you wanted to just sort of talk about what Culture of Contact is, just so people aren't like, huh, is this a cult?
Definitely not a cult, but a culture. Culture of Contact is an idea that came among us, kind of grew about a year and a half ago. It was between Farah Yardazu, yourself, Jeremy, and myself to get the idea that it was the 60th anniversary first of the modern flying saucer era, which began in 1947 with the Kenneth Arnold sighting and some sightings before that, but that was the most famous one. And so we thought we should do something here in New York, something big, something multimedia, something that combines art, music, speakers, other venues, films, movies, plays, and give a face and a voice to a vision to the experience of close encounters and all its myriad forms and varieties. And so we came together, made our plans, got the Pioneer Theater in the East Village involved. With this idea of multimedia, we also had various artists involved in an art show, both at the theater and at a local public school down the block from the Pioneer Theater. And these artists had either had experiences and portrayed them in their paintings and artwork or sculptures, or had an interest, a deep interest, abiding interest in the subject, and were able to portray it through their artworks. Also, the speakers, we had an array of speakers in this culture of contact experience, which lasted 3 days, June 22nd, 23rd, and 24th at in the East Village of New York City. And we brought the speakers together to talk about the movies and to talk about what they're doing. And it was a great gathering of not only people who were involved in this and speaking about it and giving their own voice and their own views and their own experiences, but for the public to participate, to come, to talk with the artists, to talk with the speakers, to interact with the speakers is an interactive form, because culture is an interactive form. Contact in itself is interactive. So we're bringing this to the fore and into the public for the first time, and we're going to do it again next year.
And we're going to keep doing it throughout the year with little events,
exactly.
Like, you know, doing the Whitley Strieber. Well, this is for the Whitley Strieber show, so episode. So Whitley Strieber's Culture of Contact is throwing him a book launch party September 20th. His book 2012, The War for Souls, comes out September 18th. But on that Thursday, the 20th, we're going to be throwing him a book launch party. So if you live in New York, or if you're going to be in New York, come on down to the East West Living Bookstore, which is on 5th Avenue between 13th and 14th Street. And you'll get to hear Whitley Strieber speak, and you'll get to meet him and have your book signed and all that fun stuff. And, you know, now we're doing this this radio show, which I hope you will, Harold, join me for often.
Oh, sure, of course. I'm a journalist, professional journalist for, over 20 years now, so.
So you'll be here.
Oh, I'll be here as a journalist.
So it's funny. I mean, you know, it's like the little engine that could. I mean, we started off as just this, you know, idea for, like, we need to do something, don't know what. And then it became this multi-tiered festival of arts and crafts and speakers. And now it's branching off into the internet and radio and, you know, soon the world. So I don't know. It's kind of it feels cool that this is all happening so quickly. You know, it feels like it's the right thing at the right time or something along those lines.
It definitely is, because here we're giving voice and vision and all the other things associated with the experience of contact in its many forms, in terms of sightings, stealth encounters, visitations, whatever you want to call it. We are the close encounter witnesses who have put this together. And we're communicating with the public, interacting with the public, and that is so essential for what we've experienced, to share that with the public.
What? Sorry, excuse me a sec, Harold. That's my upstairs neighbor, Satan. Trust me, if I don't answer this, he'll just keep knocking and knocking. We'll never get through this interview. So, yeah, just a sec. Oh, just you wait until I stop fake running upstairs and get to your door. Satan, what do you want?
Do you know what she did?
Do I know what who did?
Your canting daughter?
I don't know. Cunted, I'm guessing. Look, I'm on the phone. Can we do this later? Seriously, this isn't a good time. Listen, I'm not doing the knock-knock joke. Fine, who's there?
Canting. Canting.
Why do I have to go through this?
Canting.
Cunting who?
Your canting daughter.
Cunting daughter, right. Still not funny the 100th time. Listen, I gotta go, okay? Are we cool?
Let me!
I'll take that as a yes. Later, Satan.
Fuck you!
Here I am, going down the stairs. What a whiner, God. Sorry about that, Harold. It's just, he's very needy, and if I don't take care of Satan, he'll just keep banging and banging. And I don't even understand how he lives upstairs. He's Satan. He should be living downstairs, but whatever. He'd probably just bang on the ceiling. Anyway, where were we before I went into this stupid bit? Well, let me just ask you, do you think these aliens are aliens, or do you think that they're some sort of trickster force like a Satan, or something else? Not that we have any smoking gun evidence, but just what's your take on it?
We're not really looking for the smoking gun And I think if there were a gun or something that, you know, represents that, it's not the gun, it's the smoke. The smoke is more interesting because the smoke is where it's all happening and that's spreading around in its many forms, and that's where we have to look. And I think we have to my own experience in this for listeners is through the search project for aspects of close encounter space support system and proactive research organization here in the city, founded in March 1992. And the discussion we're having right now is kind of a discussion that has occurred monthly at the meetings we had for over a dozen years. What do we do with this? The big question is, what do you do with this experience? Do you sit back and go into a victim mode? That's understandable because of the nature of the experience sometimes. Or do you do something about it? And that's the essence of what we've been doing in the space group, Search Project for Aspects of Close Encounters. And I see that taking shape through culture of contact.
I'm thinking more in terms of, you know, I was reading on the internets today. Someone had posted something on a message board about shamanic journeys and how this is a lot like shamanic journeys. But over the weekend, I met this woman who's a playwright. My sister is directing a play of hers this week. And so she's staying with my sister, and she started asking me about UFOs and stuff because she knew I was, well, whatever she knows about me, I guess, that I'm an abductee. And I'm shy. You know, I'm a total hypocrite about all this stuff. Like, in public, I don't really want to, you know, have this be my first conversation with people. But, you know, I decided, what the hell, she already knows about it. So I started talking to her about it, and it turns out, not only does she have an interest, but she believes she's an abductee. And she believes she's an abductee because she had an experience of driving from her place, I believe, to her father's house, a trip that she's made 8 gajillion times. She didn't stop anywhere, but she was surprised to learn when she arrived there that she was 2 hours late. And after that experience, she started just gravitating toward alien abduction literature. And reading the stuff in there, even though she has no memory of anything, she feels like it resonates with her in such a way that she has experienced this. Like, she's reading it going, no, this is all totally familiar to me. Even though she has no memory of it, and she didn't go under hypnosis or anything. And this is a woman who is very grounded, very centered, very mature, not at all a flake, and I believe her, you know? And you know how hard that is for me to say. But I do. I just flat out believe her. And so, my question is, you know, if that's... Say that is abduction. Just go with me on this one. If that is an abductee or an experiencer, what correlation would there be in shamanic literature that... You know, where the enlightening journey is hidden from even you, and you can choose not to even look at it. Because she didn't go to a hypnotist, you know. She's not going to explore this unless it, you know, comes out in some giant flashback or something. So, I don't know. To me, it's like, yeah, I'm not here to prove any particular theory, but I would kind of like to dump some along the way, you know.
Right. It is a kind of a journey, a shamanic journey, and... what you're just talking about this person's experience. I've heard so many similar experiences, including those who do not even think about UFOs, do not think that they're missing time. The idea doesn't even come up to that. I've encountered a few people who do not know of my own background who've come out and said this, that they are missing time, they can't account for something. And never once do they mention UFOs or close encounters. Perhaps never crossed their mind, but of course, back in my mind, I won't say anything that it may have been a UFO encounter. I can't do that. It's up to the person to, you know, to express their experiences in their own words. So, but it is a kind of a journey. It's a kind of a shamanic journey all along, where views of the world, one person's perspectives change. For many people, not for all. Some people feel that the journey is taking to some place that they're familiar with, somewhere in their consciousness or subconsciousness, somewhere in their dim recesses of awareness. So that is like a journey, and it's a crossing between worlds, a cross between realities, a sharing of what's there and what's not there, how it compares with our experience and does not compare with our experience. And the beings themselves, the beings who interact with us, be they called aliens from other planets, aliens from another dimension, from a parallel world, from a future time, a computer simulation of the highest order interacting in this reality, holographic simulation that's running through all this. There's many interpretations, many possibilities. It may be all or one of these. But through our journeys, our telling of our stories, this is developing thing that we carry forth into the world. And I think in Culture of Contact, as we go along, we'll be expressing all of that experience.
So do you think it's fair to say any experience, when applied to the human mind, that is outside of the human mind, is going to appear, it's going to take the same sort of form of a shamanic journey? Like, are we always going to draw something enlightening out of it, or something similar, whether it's aliens, whether it's not aliens? You know, is it always going to look the same to us?
I don't think so. For the reasons, for instance, the UFO sightings, the early UFO sightings, the 1897-1898 airship sightings, people saw airships, dirigibles, that were not there, were invented at that time. It would be a few years before they were invented. So they had an experience which fitted their reality. This is something that's coming along within a few years, within a decade or so, but they saw it before. It was like a preview. What we are seeing now are often associated with, in the popular literature, spaceships. So we're supposing these are spaceships. What if there's something else? What if they're something that we can't even define in any language, is something beyond language, beyond our normal senses that we see and interpret for our reality and try to understand that. So I think there's going to be a big surprise at some point when we realize there's something more going on here than spaceships, abductions, visitations, whatever you want to call them, I think. That it's going to be far more profound and far more startling.
Well, maybe that's a good note to leave off on for now, and we'll pick up our conversation on future episodes of the show, because we got to get to Whitley Strieber. Do you have anything that you want to say about Whitley as a way of introduction?
Well, Whitley has a profound impact upon people, obviously, for going on 20 years now, and he had a profound impact upon my life when he had the community support groups across the country and had two meetings here in New York City in 1989 where he gave us space for the first time for us to speak about these experiences. And from that, because of that, his idea of reaching out to the visitors, which he called them being interactive, exploring that relationship with the visitors, was a profound inspiration for the founding of SPACE, the SPACE group. So I think he has influence on my life, the life of many others, and will continue to have that influence in a very positive way. He's doing very good with what he's doing.
Great. Thank you very much. Do you have
you're welcome, Jeremy.
You have a way that people can get in contact with you if they want to know more about your work?
Well, they can check out the Google search project for Aspects of Close Encounters, and you will find out there, or my email address is hegeln@webtv.net.
Great. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Jeremy. I enjoyed doing this.
Welcome to the Culture of Contact. Contact begins now.
Whitley, thank you for being my first guest ever on the Culture of Contact radio show. I guess my first question is, 2012, is it a sequel to The Grays?
No.
So it's its own book.
It's its own book.
Why don't you give us a little synopsis of what we can expect in the book?
Sure. 2012 is a work of fiction, and it is an exploration of the possible coming changes in 2012. There is a story running around that the Mayan calendar, the long count calendar, which ends on December the 21st, the solstice in 2012, heralds a change of the age. And I normally, when Jose Arguez first started talking about this, I wasn't too interested, because I've just heard so many stories about on such and such a day the world is going to end, or such and such a day the visitors are going to land, on such a day this is going to happen. However, I began to notice that there were changes taking place over the past 4 or 5 years that began to make it seem as if something, there was going to be a fundamental change in the nature of human experience on Earth. And oddly enough, it's going to be well developed by 2012, unquestionably. Just today, for example, it's been announced in the New York Times that the Arctic melt of the Arctic is occurring at what is being called an incredible speed. The Arctic is melting faster than anyone could possibly have imagined even 2 years ago. NASA recently announced that the next solar max, which will be peaking in 2012, is probably going to be the most intense in history, judging from the way the sun is acting now. And when you look at those things, when you look at things like the fact that in 2004, Greenland had 12 earthquakes in Greenland above, I think above 4.5. In the next year, 2005, it was 20 or 30. Now, in 2006, it was many, many more. And this is because as the ice melts, the land itself is shifting. And it means that Dr. Robert Hansen of NASA is right when he says all of this stuff is going to come down around our ears much faster than we expected. Okay, now what in the world would you do with that in fiction? Well, that is what I did. I decided that, first of all, my sense of it is that we're going to know the way, there's going to be no question in our minds about the way our world is going to be changing by the time 2012 actually rolls around. But it's not going to end then. However, I mean, it's not going to be unlivable then, but it's going to be pretty much in a chaotic situation. So I then looked into my own life, my own experience of close encounters of the third kind, and tried to come up with something that fit both my imagination, the world I see around me, and what I understand the physics of the close encounter experience. And what I came up with was a story that unfolds in three parallel Earths. And in part, this works off of the idea of triads, of positive, negative, and balancing, that has been so important to my communication with the Greys. And so in a sense, it has a lot to do with the Greys and their thinking. But the primary alien, quote-unquote, life form in it is reptilians. And then there are three human universes involved. And as 2012 approaches in the story, gateways begin to open between the three universes. The dark universe, which is also where real knowledge lies in the dark, is a reptilian universe. In other words, in this Earth, the dinosaurs never died out. Instead, they evolved into an intelligent life form. And yet they have all of the dreary personality characteristics of lizards, and very clever ones indeed. And their world is overpopulated and dying, and they understand these gateways. And they are going to try, as 2012 arrives, to break through into the quote-unquote good human world. In the good human world, it's entirely human. It looks almost like our world, except for some major differences. Gustav Prinship never shot the Archduke Franz Ferdinand. in 1914. In that world, World War I, World War II never happened. The world is a much more orderly place. The old European empires didn't collapse. Instead, they have evolved into freer, somewhat more democratic empires. And there's not a lot of, it's a whole different kind of a world. It's a much milder version of our world. That's where they're going to try to go. Now, in our version of it, ours is the balancing world between the two that has contact or access with both of them. In our version of it, there's one guy who happens to live just close to the geographic center of the United States, where one of the major gateways is going to open, who becomes involved. And he's a writer, and he finds that he's writing a novel which turns out to be a real history of what's unfolding in the other two worlds. And he begins to try to help the good guys by communicating to them what the bad guys are doing, because he knows it, he sees it all. He sees the whole thing. And this is the core of the novel 2012.
Your book, The Grays, was written as using fiction as a tool to get at the truths that you know and have experienced. So my question, I guess, is 2012 the same thing? Is it fiction as a tool for the things that you know to be true, or is it more that you've studied certain things and you've put them together and wanted to just create a pure fiction piece with a hint of the real?
Well, it's to a lesser extent than The Grays, because obviously The Grays is about things I do know and that I can't prove. This is about things that I think are important. I think that the parallel universes are real, and I do think that part of what we see and what we experience in what we call a close encounter experience involves this, and that when the grays draw near, the barriers between these universes become less, because they are expressed across all of them. They aren't like us at all, in that their minds have another level. Our minds work in three levels: an instinctive level, an emotional level, an intellectual level. Their minds work in another sort of a superconscious level, which sees the world from outside of space-time, and therefore sees the whole array of universes that flows and sees it from the beginning of time to the end. And this makes their consciousness very different from ours. And what I wanted to do was to try to see if I could experiment with seeing through our eyes what the worlds might look like in a consciousness like that.
Does the book deal with Quetzalcoatl at all, or any of the Mayan mythology surrounding 2012?
Not very much, no. It expresses the biblical mythology much more than it does the Mayan. And, of course, the Mayan calendar plays a significant role in it, for sure. And the idea of gateways plays a big role in it as well. But not so much the Quetzalcoatl and the Mayan gods, except implicitly. I had fun with it. There's a light touch to it, I think. I hope.
Correct me if I'm wrong in this, Whitley, but you've spent years after you'd written Communion and started talking publicly about your abduction experiences, feeling shunned by the mainstream, right? And you sort of shied away from all of that, from the limelight. So how did you go from being the sort of outcast author to all of a sudden having a string of your books being made into major, you know, summer blockbuster movies? What do you attribute that turnaround?
I don't know. It's very mysterious to me. It has something to do with the grays and the way they are expressing themselves into our world. And it has to do with their timing. It's like the U.S. government, dances to their tune more completely than you can possibly imagine, because there are a lot of people involved in this who know things that they would like to say but can't. They literally can't. It's that ability is unavailable to them because of something done to them by the grace. The secrecy that we experience isn't policy. It's our natures being affected by the will of the Greys.
So then what do you say to the disclosure movement and that whole thing? You know, do you think that disclosure is a possibility? Do you think we can even communicate with them in under normal human consciousness?
It will never be open contact in the way that we think of it, because they're too different from us. Let me tell you a little bit of personal history, if you don't mind. After the Close Encounter experience, I was attacked on every front. Even the people who should have been at least trying to look into what happened to me were attacking me. I used to have the experience of going out into the media and being laughed at one day, and then the next night being at home in a close, intimate contact situation with Greys who I knew had come to know well. And it was mind-boggling. I had them in my life not for a few months, but for 11 years. I haven't even written about most of it, because what's the point? All I'm going to do is spark more hostility from the UFO community and more rectal probe jokes if I get anything other than indifference at this point, which I think is probably what I would get. So, you know, I turned to fiction as a way of trying to express a little bit about what has happened to me and what my life has been. And you know, there's also a lot of resentment about the fact that it happened to me and not to whoever may be feeling resentment about that. I don't know why it happened to me. I have no idea. But it did, and it might be because of my family. My uncle, Mickey Strieber, was involved in the Roswell incident, and maybe that was why. I don't know. But in any case, after about 1991 or two, I just reached a point where there was so much was wrong. And then people began to find the cabin. They began to come there, and at night, and mostly to try to scare us. And local people were very, very hostile, because word got around. Workmen there would see things, and there was a person who lived down the road from us used to see these lights. When the visitors would come, there would be a big light over the cabin, and he would see these things. He was a very nice guy, but he mentioned it to different people, and soon we were being spat on when we were in the grocery store. People were scared of us, and it got to the point where the visitors had a guardian, someone who lived there all the time in the woods and behind the house, and then the problem stopped, because whatever this person was doing was keeping this all in abeyance. But he was very difficult to have around.
Was that the little guy that your son and his friends used to chase around in the woods that you told me about in our last interview?
No, that was someone different. This one is a more formidable man. I've written about him, I think, in one or two places. He looked human. He was about the size of about a 12-year-old. When I first saw him, I thought he was a child. He was in there smoking under a tree in a very dry area, and I went over to suggest to him that he not do that. And he was very formidable. He was not young. He was old, and he was a mature adult, but just physically small. And he kind of growled at me. It was really scary, really scary. But he stayed there, and he used to make little lean-tos and stuff that he would stay in, and he would come up, like, Ann and I, it was a very private place, and we used to go skinny dipping. And he hated this. It was one of the things. He did not like us out after dark. At that point, the visitors started coming to the house. And if I went out after dark, he would be out there running around. He would not be happy with that. And if we went skinny dipping, he would rush back and forth in the woods, breaking sticks and trying to drive us back inside. He just, you know, he was guarding us. And finally, we were nearly broke, and we lost the house, because no one would, who's going to buy the books of the rectal probe guy, right? I became a national joke, an international joke, in fact. And so many attacks, I mean, they have an effect. Eventually, no one would buy my books at all. And I lost the house, lost the cabin, was very seriously thinking about killing myself because I didn't see where any of this had gone. I'd been destroyed. My life was ruined.
God, and I imagine that's got to be doubly hard for you because where does somebody like a Whitley Strieber go? You can't really, what are you going to do, go to a psychologist? And
that's right. That's exactly right.
Threaten to lock you up with this stuff?
But I had the Grays, and, you know, they're very supportive of me. They help me a lot, and I've been much closer to them than I'll ever say. What's the point? It's a sacred relationship, and I don't want it to be sneered at in this wretched world. So I just keep it pretty much to myself and turn it into fiction. And it turns out that for whatever reason, the fiction it got picked up by Hollywood. I guess because science fiction is popular now, and these are unusual and intense stories. And so I was sort of saved, but I did lose the cabin. And we got a call in about 2 weeks or 3 weeks before we left. We left in quite a hurry from some woman who said that she had heard that I was going to have a hunting accident in the fall and to be careful not to walk in the woods. In other words, it was a death threat. And it was a real one, because I know that there were people in that community who were planning to kill me that fall and in a staged hunting accident when I was out walking in the woods during the day, obviously, not at night, because I didn't walk in the woods at night anymore. I didn't need to. The visitors were coming to the house. So the last night I was there, I meditated with them, the ones that used to come, and I had only seen these people in one form, which was not the form of a gray, but of a small human form. And I knew that wasn't really what they looked like. Maybe that was what they once looked like, or I don't know. But at the last night I was there, I saw this man, this being, one of these beings in its true form, and it was just incredible. Like, the person that was actually a light that had rays coming out of it, that when they penetrated you, felt like a human, a living presence, even a human presence. It was just, it was like a transfigured being. It was marvelous. Then we moved to a little condo in Texas, in San Antonio. It was on a street. And soon the guardian showed up. But he didn't work out in a condo complex at all, because people would see him. And it would make him angry when people tried to shoo him away and things, and he started climbing up the walls of the condo onto the second floor and tearing the spokes out of people's bicycles, and he would jump into the swimming pool off of a balcony and things. And so people started calling social services because they thought he was a feral child. And then they found where he was living with these two other creatures, which I think they sort of looked human, but I don't know what they were. They were living in an empty apartment immediately behind us, and the sheriff's department was called, and one day they all went left. He went marching off down the middle of the street toward the Almas Basin, which is sort of contact point. I've never seen any of them again, but I also don't need the guardians anymore because nobody knows really where I am. I'm well hidden, and we get death threats on our website, twice a week, I guess, and a little less now that the Christian fundamentalist thing is going down. I only get threatened maybe once a month now.
Well, thank God for small favors. Whitley, when you were first coming out with this stuff, and you were, you know, writing Communion and going through that process, did you ever think in a million years that with this tremendous subject of tremendous importance, the one thing that the mass media and, in fact, that people would take away from it is anal probe jokes? Did that ever even occur to you back then?
I didn't know how close this place was to hell. But let me put it this way. We are within a hair's breadth of a door opening that no one expects to see open. And I think that this is a terrible place. It's a terrible failure. We are going to go through a nightmare over the next 50 years that is far beyond anything any of these sneering fools imagine. Yeah, they're laughing now, but they're not going to be laughing later. And there will be a little island of survival in that nightmare, but it's not going to have anything to do with dried food, believe me. And I've ended up doing what I'm doing and will until I die, which hopefully will be before all of this stuff really starts to hit the fan. But yeah, I would never in a million years have bothered with this if I had known just how bad this place actually is.
Yeah, you know, when most people talk about 2012, they either think of a species dieback, some sort of great cataclysm happening, or some sort of enlightenment process unfolding, and I think it's both at the same time, you know, if it's going to be anything at all. But people find that off-putting, or they, you know, they tend to think that enlightenment means, you know, this great, happy, wonderful brotherhood, you know, where space brothers are going to come here, or whatever it is, and, you know, it just has nothing to do with that. You know, it's always going to be an abrasive process, this enlightenment. It's never going to be, it ain't going to be a cakewalk. So, you know, if that's even in the cards. Do you have a comment on any of that?
There's another level to this, and that is this. This problem we have started a long time ago. The misinterpretation of what was done by Osiris and then later by Jesus is fundamental to our failure. And at the Council of Nicaea in 325, I believe it was, AD, Jesus was put onto a cross. We were told that it was our fault, that we were guilty, and that he was to be worshipped as a god. This is all false. It's a total, you talk about heresy. Christianity, as we know it, is heresy. In fact, before that, Jesus was mostly depicted carrying a wand and a ring. And it was about the transformation of the physical body into another kind of body. And this, some people will recapture this ability. This secret will be recovered before this species comes to a complete end. And the ones that do manage this over the next 50 or 60 years will be the species' survival. That's what's happening. So in a sense, it's an evolutionary process that's going on. And I always say that, you know, evolution destroyed the dinosaurs, and it looks like a great blessing to us because we wouldn't be here unless that comet had hit the Yucatan. But it did not look so good to the dinosaurs, and they would consider it an ultimate dark evil. We're in the same position. What is happening to us is this. We're moving from Pisces to Aquarius. This is, if you look at the Gospels, you will find the most often mentioned animal is the fish, because those Gospels are the signature of the Piscean Age. It began about just about 2,000 years ago, 2,000 plus years ago. This is an age in which the fish is, and of course that's why the early Christians used the symbol of the fish, because they understood then what they really were. The fish is supported entirely in its life in the water. The water is the earth, and the earth was our best friend. The earth gave us everything during the age of Pisces. Now, however, the water carrier is pouring the water out, and the little fish ends up on land. It's happened before to life on earth. It happens regularly. Now, we are poured out. That is to say, the earth can no longer support us. So we have equipment bodies that depend on the air and the food and the water we get from the earth for our lives. That's not going to be available anymore. We have to make a leap into a new kind of life, and that is really what this age is about and what all of this is about. So the dark side of it, seen from this viewpoint, isn't really so dark. It is actually part of an evolutionary process.
As you know, there are numerous hypotheses about what aliens represent. You know, some people believe it's a trickster force. It's not even individuated beings. It's something like Satan, you know, trying to make us, believe that it's aliens. However that works. But there's also, you know, people reporting reptilians and greys and Nordics. You know, do you have a sense of what's going on here? Are all of these beings aware of each other? Are they working with each other? What's the truth?
The universe and what's in it looks as it does at any given point in history because of the way people who are enculturated at that moment see. The same array of hyperdimensional phenomena looked different 100 years ago or 500 years ago or 1,000 years ago or 10,000 years ago. And in those days, we responded to it differently. Now we see them as aliens from other planets, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And there are all kinds of fantasies about one group with these are the evil greys, these are the good greys, these are the evil reptilians, and they're good reptilians, and the Queen of England is a shapeshifted reptilian.
Yeah, that one is true, actually.
She may be shapeshifted, but I doubt it's she started out as a reptile. In any case, I don't know. It's all a big joke to me. You spend 1 second, 10 seconds, with one of these people in real life, and you realize very quickly, let me give you an idea when how complex this actually is. I used to have groups of people up to my cabin for the specific purpose of having encounters, because there was a period of time when the greys would show up in physical forms and interact with people there, a lot of people. And people would see them, and very often, a perfect example, one of them who's spoken publicly about this is a lady called Raven Dana. And Raven was in the cabin, and one of the greys came in through the window of the bedroom she was in. Now, it came in through a window which, you know, I had been not very happy about security at that cabin, because before I understood what was going on. So the windows, the screens were all screwed closed. You couldn't open them. They didn't open. They were screwed in. And this being came through the screen and woke her up by punching her in the shoulder the way they always used to wake me up. And she wakes up and she sees this big-eyed creature standing beside the bed. And she immediately thought, or no, he was sitting on the bed, excuse me, that it was a raccoon. And she'd never seen one face-to-face in physical reality before, never been with one. And I had already warned everyone that they would show up, almost certainly, because they were showing up every time we had people up at that time. And if you do not touch them extensively, because there's big-time allergic responses, really big. And they had gone through a long thing with me about, I had gone to this allergist who was a very extraordinary expert who then seems to have just disappeared from the face of the earth after giving me my allergy medicine. I went back to him and no one had ever heard of him in the office. So in any case, there's such a gap that they seem like little, I'll tell you what they seem like. They seem like little animals who are smarter than we are when you're with them. That's what they feel like. And it's weird. It's a very challenging experience. Now, later, that same being showed up in the living room where a couple of other people were sleeping on the fold-out couch. And this is what then happened. The man woke up, saw this big-headed little fellow standing there, looking at him, standing over the bed, with the big gray eyes, the classic gray, and immediately thought, oh my God, it's real. And his fear, he immediately felt a lot of fear. Whereupon the gray, it suddenly had the head, not of the big head of a gray, but the head of a hawk. And this is typical. This is as much it's a response like a lizard, you know, that puffs up when it's frightened. they do that kind of thing. They can't help it any more than we can help screaming when we're scared. But look at what it did. I mean, how different that is from what we do. And what kind of a mind must be behind something like that? It's just, it's absolutely phenomenal. Listen, forget all that stuff about all these groups and stuff. Nobody knows what the hell's going on with the Greys. The Greys, the reptilians, this, that, the other thing, they could all be the same or different. We don't know. We don't even know if they're from other planets or other dimensions or what they're from. Or if they're us from the future, who knows?
Whitley, I noticed on your website that you've started doing meditations regarding crop circles. And I'm just, oh, and by the way, you know, please, if you haven't visited unknowncountry.com, do yourself a favor and go to www.unknowncountry.com. And, you know, subscribe, become a member of Whitley's website, because there's just absolutely a ton of information there at your disposal from years and years and years, documents, audio, I believe video, etc. In any event, you've got meditations on there regarding crop circles, and I'm just wondering how do you decide that they're not just hoaxes? And then, you know, what's the information? If they're not hoaxes, what's the information that they impart via meditation?
They're not hoaxes. I've known that for a long time. I mean, obviously some are hoaxes, I suppose, but there's, you got to understand the way the Greys are. There are crop circles being made in ways that are beyond our knowledge. There are also crop circles being made by people who are expressing the will of the Greys without even knowing it. They think that they are out there making hoaxes, but they're not making hoaxes. They are doing the work that they are being made to do. And they're not conscious enough to understand their relationship with the Greys, so they simply behave. They don't really function in a fully human way. They're just acting in a robotic way. And the Greys will do that. They will use people that way anytime they want to. You have to be much more conscious if you're going to be able to have any real individuality or personality of your own if the Greys want something from you. Okay, that said, the way this whole crop circle meditation came up is, to me, quite amazing. And you have to look at the website to understand it. But suffice to say, it's part of a complex communication that's going on right now between us and the Greys. And it is involving a test of how well we can respond to a new level of relationship with them. And that test has been isolated within a certain social group that surrounds my website, Linda Moulton Howe's website, and to a lesser extent, the Coast to Coast website. It's been very isolated in that group on purpose by the Greys, so that their way of addressing this can be refined to another level, and when it eventually will reach a somewhat larger group as the planetary situation becomes more and more desperate and people become more willing to turn toward the Greys and to give up this thing that keeps us from growing, which we call ego.
And that is the perfect note to end this interview on, Whitley. I'd like to thank you for being a spectacular guest, as always. Amazing to speak with you. And I'll be seeing you soon. I'll be seeing you, September 20th, for the book launch here in New York of 2012, The War for Souls.
That's right. Thank you for the book launch, by the way.
You, my friend, are more than welcome. Take care.
You too.
And that'll about wrap her up for the Culture of Contact. Thank you very much, Harold E. Gelm, for checking in with us. And thanks to our special guest, Whitley Strieber, for being the first ever guest on Culture of Contact. His book, 2012, The War for Souls, comes out September 18th, but you can pre-order it now from Amazon.com, actually through the link provided here, if you like, on the podcast. But either way, pick it up. First of all, Strieber is a fantastic, just plain old outright novelist, so you're going to get a great story no matter what. But if you're like me and you don't really care to mix your fiction with your nonfiction in terms of aliens and UFOs and 2012 and all that fun stuff, get the book anyway. I'm gonna. And the reason is, Strieber is in this. He is an experiencer. He is of this. So It's a safe bet that even his most wildly imaginative fiction is probably better than the best quote-unquote nonfiction on any subject of this kind. So you're always going to learn something new and something real, whether he puts the word fiction or nonfiction on his books. And if you're in the New York area, September 20th, you can come on down to the East West Bookstore on 5th Avenue between 13th and 14th Street at 6:30 p.m. And Streber will sign your book. You can hear him talk. You can ask him questions, you know, interact. I'll be there. Harold will be there. Culture Contact representing. So yeah, come on out. Next week's guest will be Steve Bassett, who's the country's only UFO disclosure lobbyist, you know, pushing Washington, asking them what the hell do they know and when do they know it? Not much, I'd say. But he hosts the X Conference, and we'll be talking to him about that. That's coming up also in September. So yeah, come on back next week. We'll have plenty more show, more inappropriate comedy, and more independent music for you, because that's just how we roll here at the Culture of Contact. So until next week, I leave you with these sage words. I know not what course others may take, but mine is changing now. And that's true. I mean, I don't know what I just said, but it's true. Take care.